Okay, let's get started. My name is Marshall Clow. I work for Qualcomm. One of my jobs is that I maintain the C++ standard library implementation for LLVM, libc++. I also work on the standards committee defining what it is that the C++ library does or can do or has to do or must not do. Anyway, one of the things that various people have talked about in the last several years is using standard algorithms as in your code. And just see this. Okay. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and then I'm going to talk about the advantages and disadvantages, and then I'm going to talk about extending the list of algorithms that you have available to you by writing your own. Anytime if you have any questions about this, just put your hands up and I'll try to answer them right away. Occasionally, I will answer them with, hang on to it, I have a slide coming up about that, but mostly I'll ask them right away. The other thing is this, there's a fair amount of code in this talk, but none of it is particularly intricate. It should be fairly straightforward and easy to understand. Also, all the code in this presentation compiled and ran successfully at least once before I pasted it on the slides and started dinking with it to make it fit. So it worked once. Okay, so we'll start with what is an STL algorithm? STL stands for Standard Template Library, not Stefan T. Lalouev, just to disambiguate. And this was a proposal back in 92 or 93 by Alexander Stepanov and a couple other people to basically help generic programming in the C++ standard library. And that proposal was picked up and incorporated into the standard library. So really, we should talk about just what is the standard library, not the standard template library, because one incorporates the other. And there haven't been separate since, I think it was adopted in 94. Okay, so basically we're going to talk about algorithms. What is an STL algorithm? It is a templated function. It is a function template that not a class that you can instantiate, but rather a templated function. It does something useful, something you might want to do in a generic way. And also very important, it has a good name. The standard library gets to squat on useful names like copy and find and erase and remove and things like that. So when you're doing your stuff, you either have to put it in a different namespace or give it slightly less generic names. There are a bunch of collections of algorithms. Besides the ones in the standard library, there is the Boost Algorithms Library, which is a collection of useful libraries. There's the Adobe Source Libraries, ASL, that have another collection of good algorithms. And there are probably, I'm certain there are bunches more that I don't know about, hidden in code bases that are not open source, or just I don't know about them, I haven't heard about them. And so there's a lot of different algorithms out there. So why should we use an STL algorithm? Why do you want to do this instead of writing it all yourself? I mean, right? We didn't go into software developers to be software developers to use other people's code. We all wanted to write code, right? So the STL algorithms are carefully specified and have been implemented to be reasonably efficient. They've been debugged, they've been tested on a wide variety of platforms. Certainly for libc++, when I check in a new version of COUNTIF or something like that, there are 30 bots on 10 different architectures that go off and run a bunch of tests and come back and scream at me if I broke something. Also, the algorithms in the standard library tend to be very, very basic. They're building blocks. You can build other algorithms on top of them, including them. And this is really nice. Also, in general, writing code using these algorithms is easier than writing them yourself. I had a conversation with Chandler just this week, who was talking about working on a particular chunk of the LLVM path, optimization chain, and he was working on a particular data structure, and he writing some code and looking at it, it's complicated, and he realized that he had just implemented poorly, his word, not mine, okay, just so you think I'm not slamming on Chandler, even though he's not here because he's got to talk right now. He had implemented poorly STD partition. And he said, once he realized that, and he replaced a big chunk of code with a call to STD partition, and then did the stuff that was not relevant, you know, the not part of partitioning his data set, he was much happier. His code was smaller. It was easier to reason about. It was easier. He was more confident that it was right. Yeah, it's easier to review later. So I have a chunk of code here. Actually, I have two chunks of code here. The white code, the pieces of white code are the same. The pieces of green code are different. Can anybody tell me what those two pieces of green code do? They're separate. Okay. I heard somebody say bubble sort, and that is in fact correct. This is an implementation of bubble sort. So if you were looking at somebody's code and you came across either this one or this one, which do you think you'd rather see? If you were doing a code review and one of your code workers presented this one or this one with you, to you, which one do you think is better? Which one would you rather review? Which one is easier to assure yourself that it is correct, convince yourself that it's correct? Okay? I look at this up here, and I look at this thing here where it says I is less than equal to v.size, and then right below j is less than v.size minus 1, and I wonder, why are those different? Is this code actually correct? What's going to happen here if I sort a one-element array or a no-element array? And I have to go to a lot of work. I have to spend a lot of cycles thinking about this and maybe even pulling it out and running it through some tests to convince myself that it's correct. This one, on the other hand, I'm pretty sure it's correct. I look and make sure that the right parameters are passed to sort. If there was a comparison predicate here, I'd look at the comparison predicate and make sure it actually defined a total strict ordering or weak strict ordering, and then I'm done. Just for your information, I did pull that code out. I didn't write that myself. I Googled bubble sort and found an implementation online and slapped it in there, but I stuck it in a test harness and ran it against a few test cases, and it is correct. It does sort things, but it doesn't actually fill me with confidence to see this. Now, I have to spend a lot of effort trying to convince myself that it's correct. Okay, so we're gonna get some examples of algorithms. The simplest algorithm, this may be the simplest algorithm in the standard library, min. It takes const references, two const references, and returns the lesser of them. It returns b if they're equal. So, well, a couple of things to take away from this. This is very general. It compares two things of the same type. It has a couple operations here that you have to be valid on this type. You have to be able to compare them. It has to be able to do a less than. Because we're passing references here, reference, reference, return a reference, we don't have to worry about copying them. We don't have to worry about, you know, are these default constructible or anything like that. All we need is to use less than on them. There's also a version of, actually there's not. I was thinking of another one. But this is a very simple algorithm. It has very few requirements on the type T. The standard library prefers to minimize the use of minimize the list of capabilities that it imposes on the objects it processes. In general, less than and equal are used as opposed to, say, greater than or equal or greater than or something like that, which means sometimes you see the conditions. If you read the STL code or the algorithm's code, you'll see they go through a couple hoops to use less than instead of greater than. Well, you know, less than is just greater than equal to turned around. So it's not really that hard to do. It just sometimes is a little bit awkward. And on iterators, which we'll see in a minute, the standard library tends to use not equal and pre-increment. Okay, here's another one. Copy. This may be the most used algorithm in the standard library. Copy. It takes two different kinds of iterators. And this used to say input iterator and output iterator, but then it didn't fit on the slide. So iiter, oiter, it takes two input iterators that denote a range and an output iterator to write to. And it uses this interesting for loop construct to avoid having to do post-increment. You could write this as while first is not equal to last, star res plus plus equals star first plus plus. But then you'd have to use output iterators. Not output iterators, but post-increment on the iterators. And we try to avoid that. On the other hand, the compiler will, in fact, generate pretty much the same code for that. The compiler will generate very efficient code for this, even though that the phrasing of the for loop is a little bit awkward. So what happens here? Now, what are we doing here with these operations? We're comparing the iterators. We're incrementing the iterators, two different kinds of iterators, iiter and oiter. And then we're reading from this. We're indirecting both of them, but we're indirecting and reading from first, and we're writing to res. And then we're returning res by value. So we have to be able to copy an output iterator. How many of you were in Patrick's talk this morning up in the theater at 9 o'clock? He spent an hour building up a theoretical basis for iterators. So, and he talked about copy a lot. But you know, this is the nice thing about this, as Patrick pointed out this morning, is you only need one copy if you push the traversal and the writing off into the iterators, then there's only one copy algorithm, and it works for lists, it works for arrays, it works for vectors, it works for file streams, it works for whatever. I mean, there's a very neat trick where you can have a sequence and you want to print it to the console. You say copy from begin of sequence, end of sequence, and then you pass it an OStream insert iterator. And it just copies them to the OStream insert iterator, which puts them out on the console, writes them to C out, say. Okay, any questions about min or copy? Didn't think so. So let's write our own. These are not going to be horribly complicated, algorithms. They're designed to just show you these are the kind of things you can do yourself. And I expect that many of you have written more complicated ones already. You had a question.
On a previous slide for copy, why isn't the input iterator a constant iterator?
The question is, why are the input iterators here?
I believe it's the first.
The input iterators, why are these not const iterators? There's two kinds of const for iterators, okay? This iterator is a constant iterator. You can't do anything with it. So this would be const space iterator. And then there is containers, have two kinds of iterators. They have iterators and const iterators. Those are const underscore iterators. And those are two separate types. It's a const plain iterator is different from a const underscore iterator. And the reason is this doesn't say const is because these are template parameters here. And you can pass a const iterator here just fine. You would have to specify in the input iterator that this is something you're not that cannot be written to, well, it's not that you can't write to it, it's just that we're not going to write to it. So it doesn't have to, you don't have to pass a const iterator here, it's just the fact that we're not writing to it in this algorithm. It could be a writable iterator, we're just not writing to it. It doesn't help with performance. No, that was the other, your follow-up question, does it help with performance? And no, I don't believe it does. Okay. So we have a, I'm going to talk about a made-up algorithm called adjacent pair. So we have for each. For each, you give it a sequence and a functor. A functor is something that's callable. That's really the definition of functor. It can be lots of things, but basically, if you can call it like a function call, then it's a functor. You know, if you put a pair of parens off the end of it and pass parameters to it, then it's a functor. Anyway, adjacent pair, what it does is it calls the functor with two items, not just one. For each does it for each element. Adjacent pair would do it for each pair of elements. And when I say each pair, I mean pairs next to each other in the sequence. So if you had a sequence that was, say, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, the pairs would be 1, 3, 3, 5, 5, 7, 7, 9. Okay? So let's think about this for a second, and you say, how would you write this? Okay. And fortunately, I have done so. So let's look at a couple of things here. We talk about, again, up here, this was a much longer name when I started, but it didn't fit on the slide. So I used FW iterator for forward iterator. This being a template name, a template type name, doesn't actually have any enforceability, but it gives the reader an idea that, yes, I need forward iterators here because we're going to go through the sequence more than once. It takes two iterators, a sequence to, and a function to call. And basically, you drop an iterator at the beginning, and then march them through the sequence one element at a time, advancing them both so that we have 1, 3, and it advances them both 3, 5, 5, 7, 7, 9. And that's about all there is. We pass the functor x, gets the two elements from the sequence because we dereference the iterator. How that actually happens depends on f because it's a template function. It might be that f takes these by reference, by const reference, or by value, or maybe f takes some related type, and there are implicit conversions there. It's in any case, that all just works. One of the things I want to notice here is we have up here if first is not last, because when you write your algorithms, you want to make sure that you handle degenerate cases. You handle the simple cases correctly. You know, copy, right? If you say copy from an empty range, what does copy do? It does nothing. It doesn't signal an error or anything. It says, you gave me nothing to copy, I'm going to copy nothing, and now I'm done. Adjacent pair for each. You say for each of an empty range, and here's this functor. It calls that functor for every element in the empty range, i.e. none of them, and so it calls the functor no times. Adjacent pair handles that as well. If you give it a zero element range, it calls the functor no times. If you give it a single element range, it calls the functor no times because there are no pairs. So you end up calling the functor with pairs, you know, n minus one times for an n element sequence. You know, 1, 3, 5, 7, 9 has four pairs in it. Again, this is not a rocket science algorithm. Okay, this is not, you know, solving world hunger or, you know, optimizing assembly code or anything like that. This is a very simple algorithm. We're just going, but it's to illustrate that you can write an algorithm that does actually something significant, a few lines of code, and if you have a need for this functionality, you can pick this up, drop it into your code base, and use it. The idea is that you, as you go along, you will build up a set of algorithms. They may be very general algorithms like copy or sort or something like that, or they may be specific to your business or the problem you're trying to solve. But the point is that you can abstract them out a little bit, make them more general, use them in multiple places. You can, once you've abstracted them out, they're easy to write tests for. You can write tests and make sure that they do the right thing in all the cases, empty, single element, multiple elements. And then you have confidence in using them, and then you start seeing things in your code that looks like this. Do I have? I think my laser has died. Anyway, things like, you know, call to sort. Did I mention, by the way, that it's important to give your algorithms good names? Because there's a lot of semantic meaning behind sort. Everybody knows what sort is supposed to do. Okay, everybody knows what copy is supposed to do. You may have to read the documentation to discover exactly what copy does, but you can look at that in a chunk of code and you can see that it's going to copy something, or it's going to sort something, or it's going to find something. Okay, so giving your algorithms a good name instead of, say, QNX1137 is, again, helps with understanding when you're reading the code. What have you got there, Howard? Ah, thank you.
Red button at the top.
Thank you, Howard. Yep. Oh, now mine's working again. Thank you. I'll just put it up here because it'll probably fail again. Anyway, so again, writing important names, writing good names, you know, useful names, and names that convey meaning is a big part of this. Okay, how about this? What if we wanted all the pairs, not just the adjacent ones? How would you write that algorithm? Similar problem, slightly different. And when I say all the pairs, I mean, say, you know, again, we have 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 1, 3, 1, 5, 1, 7, 1, 9, 3, 5, 3, 7, 3, 9, 5, 7, 5, 9, 7, 9, you know, all of the pairs, but not 9 and 1. Basically, all the pairs irrespective of order. Now, we're wandering into combinatorics here, but that's okay. Anyway, so we have for all pairs. Okay, and it is the, it starts out the same, because we want to not do anything quietly, successfully on an empty sequence. But what do we do here now? We have two nested for loops. We still drop the trailer, but we go from, this loop basically updates the trailer, and this goes from the trailer to the end. So you get 1, 3, 1, 5, 1, 7, 1, 9, and then the trailer gets incremented. The next time you get 3, 5, 3, 7, 3, 9. 3, 5, 3, yeah, 7, 3, 9, and it gets again 5, 7, 5, 9, and so on. Obviously, this is an n-squared algorithm. This, you know, this is because there are n-squared possible pairs in a thing of size n, well, n minus 1 squared, but that's okay. This is an order n-squared algorithm. And it is not really much different. If you go back and look at the structure of this, it's basically we're adding another loop down here. It's a different algorithm, but it's related. So let's see. Any questions so far? Yes. Yes, if you have questions, please don't wait for me.
I believe that these adjacent pairs and for all pairs will not work if the sequence is only two elements.
You believe it will not work if there's only two elements?
Yes, because then after plus plus first shows the last, and the fourth loop won't start. Or am I mistaken?
So if there are...
Only two elements.
Two elements, after you plus plus first, it will point to the second element. Not, so they will have first plus plus, and last. Because remember, last is one past the end.
Oh, okay. So I am mistaken.
No worries. Yes. I could have specified funct more precisely by using std function and say that it takes two parameters of a particular type. I certainly could have, but this actually accepts a wider range of functors. In particular, it accepts things that have where it may have multiple parameters that have default values, or things that it takes parameters of types that are implicitly convertible from whatever I pass it to whatever it accepts. And certainly, there are places where that's a good idea. If, for example, you don't want this to be a template parameter, then you could, because standard function gives you type erasure, you can pile a whole bunch of things into a standard function that takes two parameters of particular types. But this is more flexible. You certainly can pass a standard function here. Other questions?
Is there a reason you always use first not equal to last instead of first not must be less than last?
I'm sorry, the question was, is there a reason I use first not equal to last as opposed to first less than last?
First less than last.
Ah, because suppose I'm working with, say, a list. Okay, with forward iterators, they don't define a ordering of the iterators. I mean, less than will work if I'm working with raw pointers. Well, okay, if I'm in a list, a node might be here, a node might be here, a node might be here. There's no ordering of iterators in general. Random access iterators may have ordering, but forward iterators and bidirectional ones do not. All right, the only thing you really get with non-random access iterators is equality, not equals. Okay, more algorithms. These are ones that that I have had need for and have written in the past. Copy while. This actually I wrote for the Boost Algorithms library. It basically, you give it an input range, an output, and a predicate, and it copies things from the input range to the output range until the as long as the predicate is satisfied. So if you were to say, give a predicate that says these numbers are odd, and you give it 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, it will copy the entire input sequence. But if you give it 1, 3, 2, 4, 6, it will copy the 1 and the 3 and then stop and return, and leaving the input iterator. Leaving the input sequence pointing at 2. Now, there's the first time I wrote this, I had a bug. Well, let's actually go over the code, right? Well, first is not last, and predicate first, copy. Okay, so except for this P first, this condition, it looks just like copy. So the first time I wrote this, I just returned the output iterator, because that's what copy does. And somebody pointed out to me that, how do you know how far in the list you got? Because you've tossed away the input iterator that you've modified. And this is not important for input streams, input iterators, things like streams, single pass streams, because you can recover the iterator from the underlying source, say it be an IF stream or something like that. But if you're traversing a list or a string or something like that, you have no way of knowing how far it got in the sequence. And so instead, now I return a pair of iterators. The input iterator, the modified input iterator, which points to the first thing that wasn't copied, and the output iterator. Interestingly enough, when Alex Stefanov wrote the papers about the original papers about the STL, one of his guiding principles was don't throw away useful information in your algorithm, return it back to the users. They might throw it away, return it to the caller. They might throw that information away because it's not useful to them. But you should not make that decision for them. You should, in fact, return it to them because they might need it. And then he put copy n, copy underscore n, into the STL, which did exactly that, did just like this. It advanced an input, one of the iterators, n places, and then threw it away and didn't return it. So I feel a little better that that Alex Stepanov made the same mistake I would. Doesn't mean I'm as smart as him, not even close. But I'm glad to see, was a little bit glad to see that this was not something that I, some mistake that I made up all on my own. But anyway, a real simple algorithm. This is three lines, I mean three lines of declarations and three lines of code. And if you need something like this, paste in your code base and use it. There are a whole set of related copy algorithms. You know, there's copy if, right? Copy all the things that the predicate matches. That goes to the end of the sequence. Copy while, copy until. You know, and various people have needs of those. You can decide. You know, if you have a set of these, you can decide exactly which one is right for you. And they're easy to write. This one's a little trickier, and it's actually not really complete here, because there's lots of interesting design decisions here that I chose not to do to keep this on a slide. But this is split. It takes a pair of iterators and a value and a functor, and it basically searches for the value in the sequence, and it calls the functor with the sequence. Basically, this is, you know, splitting, say, a string on commas. It finds the comma, passes from the beginning of the string up to the comma, to the functor, and then starts searching again immediately after the comma for the next comma, and calls the functor again, and continues until the string is exhausted. So what does it do? Finds it, calls first found, always calls the functor every time it searches, because maybe, you know, you may, even if it didn't find a comma, you've got the stuff at the end of the string. And then if it got to the end of the string, then it breaks. Otherwise, goes around again. Lots of things you can do here, okay? This question is, what's the best control structure here? Do you want to really call a functor? Do you want to pass an output iterator, which is given the pair of iterators so it can write it into a container? Gore would probably argue that you want to do this with coroutines, some kind of stateful operator. I don't know. Also, you can generalize the matching functions here. It doesn't have to be std find that finds just a single value. You could say find one of a set. If you remember, std string has these calls for find first of and find first not of. You could pass in a regular expression. You could pass in a sequence. You know, you could separate things by a, b, c, d. There's all sorts of things you could do here. This is a very simple implementation of split, and yet it's very useful and very general. Beeman. Oh, Patrick, was yours? Good point. Patrick pointed out that we want these to be forward, this first and last to be forward iterators, not input iterators, because find requires forward iterators. You certainly can't advance it and then say, here's the sequence that I've destroyed. Yes, Beeman. Mm-hmm. So, right. What Beeman said is when I wrote find, and based on what I said, he was thinking that find really could be a customization point, and you could pass a second functor in and have it search on those. And I actually have thought about that, especially since we have, in C++7, we have these search algorithms that implement various search algorithms. It's different, you know, we have these search objects that implement search algorithms, and yes, you could certainly do that. What I would like to see, actually, if I have written one of these and stashed it away because I got busy with other stuff, that takes a searcher algorithm rather than a value, and actually put a couple more besides the ones that are in the C++17 standard. Yes? Oh, absolutely. Fine might be a very good default, right? One of my searchers, the searchers I wrote to test this, was something that took a single object and just found it and called stdfind on it, right? It is a good default, especially since you're breaking up a CSV string with commas, say, or something like that. Question here. Oh, the question is, do I need a T here, or can I write iter colon colon value type? I could write iter colon colon value type, I believe, but at the same time, that actually precludes some interesting, some possibilities for the searching there. If you have a searcher, for example, that can do heterogeneous stuff, we have some of that in map and so on, where you can do. If you did that, then the conversion would happen here at this calling site, as opposed to happening here, say, or maybe not at all if the searcher was polymorphic. And so by using T, you put off that decision and maybe give the user a chance to not actually have that conversion happen at all. I thought I saw somebody over here. No? Okay, down here in front. And then you're next. Why is the function passed by copy instead of by reference or something? Or by perfect forwarding? Mostly because that's what most of the standard library does. The newer portions of the standard library can pass it either by value or by perfect forwarding. I tended to match, since I was doing things like copy and so on, I tended to match that. That's an interesting little project to do, to research those and see what the actual difference is. And we need to do a survey of a bunch of code bases to see, do people routinely call things like this with big stateful functions that are expensive to copy? If they do, then yeah, by a forwarding reference would be a good idea. I mean, would help a lot. But if they don't, if they're usually function pointers or lambdas with minimal captures, then it's not going to make a difference. So that's something I ought to look into. Thank you. You had a question over here. Yes. Is there any reason to be concerned that found would never be equal to last? Okay, so let's start with, can that actually happen? Okay, so every time we go through this loop, this will return something that is at least first, right? Okay, if we get to last, we're done. Otherwise, we move past the thing that was found. So we're advancing through the sequence every time through this loop, okay? Now, even if first and found are the same, we're still going to advance through the loop. Now, if you cannot get to last by incrementing first over and over again, you're going to get stuck in find, but you're going to get stuck in all the algorithms in that. That's one of the prerequisites of basically all the sequence algorithms in the standard library. It's in general, if you passed a first and a last, an input sequence, one of the requirements is that last is reachable from first. I mean, if we go back to, can we go all the way back to copy? Same thing. If last is not reachable from first, yeah, then this is not, copy is not ever going to return, find is not ever going to return, potentially. Okay, how are we doing? We've got 20 minutes. Okay. Whoops, did copy while, did split. All right, general guidance for writing your own. Somebody said once, hunger is the best spice. Makes your food taste really good when you're hungry. Same thing here. Write what you need. If you find yourself needing something, needing a chunk of code to do a particular task, and you've written it in a non-generic manner, look at it, think about it for a little while. You say, is there some general solution hiding in here that you can tease out? You know, can you tease it out, make it a little more general so it's applicable in some other part of your code base? If so, pull it out a little bit. Make it a little more general. It doesn't have to be universal. You can have algorithms that have a bunch of requirements. It has to be like this and so on. The more general you make them, the more widely applicable they are, and so it's more likely that other people will use them. But you don't want to do that at the cost of efficiency. You want your algorithms to be quick, because then there's more of advantage to using them than to roll your own. Also, stepwise refinement. Write it, try it, make sure it's correct, look at the code, refactor it, think some more. Is there a better way to do this? Sometimes you realize that the problem you're solving is different from what you thought you were solving. And so you end up with something that's like, well, this is good, but this is not the problem I really want to solve. And then you say, darn, and you say, okay, there's a bigger problem here waiting to get out. I can make it more general just like this, and it solves my original stuff and a lot of other things. But, how many people were here, was it a couple years ago for Bjarne's keynote, or last year for Sean's talk, and they talk about the algorithm called Gather, the history of that? Nobody. Okay, I'm going to spend a couple minutes talking about Gather, because it was my algorithm. I got hired into Qualcomm to work on Eudora, which is an email program, which is now dead. But it had a couple cool features. It was a nice email program, tough to compete with free when lots of people are giving away free email clients, but oh well. One of the things it had is if you hold down a modifier key and click on a name in a mailbox, it would pull all the emails to that person if it was sent, or from that person if it wasn't a sent mailbox, together. It would basically impose a custom sorting order. It would pull them all together. And if you held down that key and clicked in the subject field, it would pull all the messages with that subject, modulo re and forward and so on. It's really, really nice. And I've never seen any other email client do this. It was like, you could pull an entire conversation together, and it left them selected, which then you could move to another mailbox or something like that. You click in the date column, and it would all the messages for a particular day. These kind of things. Anyway, so I started thinking about that, and it's like, that sounds like a useful algorithm. And so I went off and implemented it, and I called it Gather, and I looked at it, and I showed it to Sean, and it was like, this is a nice little algorithm. And he looked at it and said, yeah, that's a really good idea. I can use that. And then he looked at it some more, and he said, you realize this is just two calls to partition, don't you? And I said, I hate you, Sean. Because what it is you have a point where you click, right? An element there. And so you have two halves of a section. You have a beginning and end of the messages, and you have a point where you clicked. And so what you do is you take the first half of it from the point up, and you partition the messages. You actually call stable partition, so it keeps the relative order. And all the messages that match a predicate, which are like, have this subject, come to the end. And then you do this again with the other half, except you invert the predicates, so all the messages that match the predicate come to the beginning, and you end up with all the messages you want right there in the middle, and everything else is in the same order it was before. And I was doing it with, you know, swap and rotate and so on, and he said, like, two calls to partition. Oh. Way too easy. And it turns out that partition does the exact right thing if you give it an empty range and all that stuff, so if you click on the last, you do this on the last message in there or the first message in there, it just works. So you want to think about what you need. You want to make it general, but then you want to think about, how can I make this better? Are there tools that will help you with this? And this goes back to Chandler, the anecdote about Chandler. You know, I wrote partition poorly. there are lots of, you can use the existing algorithms as building blocks. know, in here, I used std find as a building block. But yeah, if you can find Sean's talk about std gather, he's got a really nice explanation about it, and or not std gather, just gather. It's not in the standard library. And he's got animations that show exactly how it works. I think that was last year. I know that Bjarne used it in his keynote 2 years ago at the first CppCon. Anyway, so other tips. You want to handle degenerate cases well. Okay, you don't want to force your callers to check and make sure that they don't hand you an empty sequence or for pairs it's something that has one. Just do the right thing. Figure out what the right thing is and do it. When we define a set of predicates in the standard library for any of, all of, none of, and you give it a predicate, the question is, what does it do if you give it an empty sequence? All of returns true, because everything in the sequence matches the predicate, and so on. You just need to figure out what the right thing to do is and do it. Be aware of the operators you're using. When I talked about one of the other ones, we talked about copy. Talked about what operations we used on the iterators, what operations we used on the value. Min is the nice small one. It only uses less than. It doesn't do any copies or anything like that. It doesn't have any iterators, so it doesn't implement them. You worry about your complexity. Is this a log n? Is this an n log n? Is this an n squared, n cubed, heaven help you? And think about iterator categories. Are people here familiar with iterator categories? I mean, I know Patrick is because he worked through them this morning. But we have, we have input iterators and forward iterators and so on, and bidirectional and so on. You think about iterator categories. Do you want to work with input iterators, right? We have problems with input iterators is they model a sequence you can only pass over once. Sometimes you'll end up having completely different implementations based on the iterator category. libc++ for one algorithm for find end actually has three different implementations, one for random access iterators, one for forward iterators, one for bidirectional iterators, because you can do things more efficiently if you have more information, capabilities. Some of the algorithms, like the four iterator version of equal, for example, or is permutation or so on, perform much better in simple cases on random access iterators. Is permutation takes two sequences and says, is this one a permutation of another? This is an expensive operation. It's basically an n squared operation. But if you hand me a pair of random access iterators and I can determine that this one's three elements long and this one's four elements long, I can tell you right away, not a permutation of them. I don't even need to look at any of the elements. I can tell you that. Random access iterators give you constant time calls to std distance that tells you how big the sequence is. So, if you know what your iterator type is, you can sometimes do much better. So let's look at a JSON pair again. And this was, we have forward iterators. So we drop an iterator and say, great, this is the same code as before. Okay, but somebody says, no, I need you to make this work with input iterators. And so you say, okay. And you think about it for a while and you realize that you can write something like this. Rather than dropping an iterator, you can save a copy of the last value and use that for your comparison. Now, I just want to point out that this is effectively copying the entire sequence, one element at a time, into this local variable. And you have to actually figure out what type this is. So I'm going to introduce something new that probably most of you are aware of, but I'm going to talk about. The standard library has this templated class called iterator traits. that tells you things. If you give it an iterator, it tells you things about the iterator. It'll tell you what its category is, what kind of iterator is it, random access is input, is output, and so on. One of the things it will tell you is what is its value type? What do you get back if you dereference it? Okay, and so you can write this, type name std, iterator traits, input iterator, value type, boom. And that is the right type, and that will not, you know, you won't have any conversions here and so on. Now, of course, in C++ 11, 14, you just write auto, but it's important to know what's going on there. You are, in fact, copying a value out of the sequence and saving it away. So you are effectively one, donk, 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 each time through that, each time through here, here, and then here, you are copying the value. If this is a stream of characters, it's just not a big deal. But if it's a sequence of things that are expensive and big and maybe hold things that, or even if they're not copyable, then this isn't going to work. And so you, somebody says to you, you want this to work for input iterators, this is going to be mostly more expensive than the one that works for forward iterators. Not for me to say that you shouldn't do that. You know, your situation is different from mine, is different from his, everybody's situation is different, and maybe you need this functionality, but at least you should be aware of what you're asking for, or what people are asking for here. Question over here. Are you allowed to dereference input iterators more than once before incrementing them? I believe you are. The question was, are you allowed to dereference input iterators more than once between incrementing them? I believe you are, but now you're going to make me go look. Certainly, if you are not, you can introduce another local variable in here and fix that, but I'd have to go look. Let's pretend that you can, because otherwise it's not going to fit on the slide. It's a good question, though. So the other question is, how do you choose an implementation? Again, iterator traits is your friend. Iterator traits, iterator category is names a type. And the type is one of these things, a set of tags that are defined by the standard library. There's input iterator tag and forward iterator tag and bidirectional iterator tag and random access iterator tag and also output iterator tag. And so, and there's an inheritance relationship between them. They're all subclasses of each other, which means if you say you take a forward iterator tag, that will match up against a bidirectional, a random access, and a forward, but not an input iterator. And so you can add template specializations based on that, and you can, this is called tag dispatch, and you can dispatch based on them. So here, here's a chunk of code, here's a couple chunks of code, declarations actually. This is one that takes forward iterators. I've named this impl, okay, for implementation. Forward iterator, forward iterator, forward iterator, forward iterator tag. This is the original implementation, okay, that we saw 15 slides ago. Input iterator, same thing. Input iterator tag, this is the one from a couple slides back. And then adjacent pair, return, adjacent pair implement, first, last, F, type name, iterator traits, iterator category, open paren, close paren. C++ 14, you use open squirrely brackets, close squiggly brackets. But you're constructing an object of that type and passing it as a parameter. Now these are empty structs. The constructor is a no-op. They are, they would be size zero if only we had size zero objects. So they're going to be, you know, 1 byte long, or whatever your compiler decides is the size of an empty struct. So they're very cheap to construct, as in allocate some space. They don't have any member functions. They're just types that you can use to choose an implementation. And this technique is used all throughout the standard library, when you have to have different implementations based on the iterator type. And we are at the end. And we have about 5 minutes for questions. So anybody has any questions? Okay. Over here.
Question.
So you're looking here, you have two increments. Trailer equals first.
So premature optimization. What are your thoughts?
My thought is that if I were suggesting another way to do this, to do an assignment as opposed to two increments here, right in here, do an assignment versus assign trailer to first and then increment trailer. And I don't know. I would have to measure to see which would be better, which would be faster. This is a pattern I'm very familiar with. It's used in a lot of places. So it never even occurred to me that doing an assignment and then an increment might be faster. Beeman's got his hand up. So let me try to summarize what Beeman said. I got the impression that you think that the difference will be small. But in particular, he said he thinks that any difference here would be dependent on what version of the compiler it was, and if you in fact had a noticeable difference, that it might disappear the next time the compiler upgraded their optimization strategy, which. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, I don't think it's clearer.
I think it's clearer to write there, but that may be just because that's the formulation I'm used to. I don't know. Two over here. How about one, then two? Is there any reason that these algorithms like this and a bunch of the other ones in the standard library cannot be made const-expert? And the answer is yes for some of them and no for others. And the follow-up question was, are there any plans for making them const-expert? And yes, there are. You won't see that in C++ 17, but you will see it pretty soon afterwards. There were some people playing with stuff at the last standards meeting, basically trying it out, and we discovered that some library implementations were at the current time were not amenable to that, and that other library implementations were amenable to that, but they managed to crash their compiler. So there was no real happy implementers there. There was the one people who were feeling pretty good about their library, but their compiler crashed, and the other people who were looking at their library said, I gotta do some work here to make this const-expert. But if I just hack something together, my compiler is happy with it. So, there was another question over here. Yes? One more behind split. Yes? Wow. Good catch. The question was, why is there a post increment on result here rather than having it up here in the loop? Because if you go back and look at copy, it does a pre-increment on the output iterator here, which is more general. I mean, this copy while, yes. Copy while imposes an extra requirement on the output iterator. It must support post increment. Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you.